Welcome to our first episode of Oben ohne, which means topless in German. This special episode is done in celebration of the second International Flat Day, and I'm very excited to introduce my guests from the USA and UK to you. My first guest today is Kimberly Bowles from the US, president of the non-profit organization Not Putting on a Shirt. She will share her thoughts about the importance of clear language in regards to aesthetic flat closure with us. My second guest is Dvorah Vesta, who is also from the US and secretary of Not Putting on a Shirt, who will talk about informed consent in mastectomy decision-making. My third guest today is Juliet Fitzpatrick from the UK, and she will share with us how visibility of flatness can help change the stigmatization that's still happening today. I will wrap up this episode on some of the ways in which the international flat community has inspired us in Germany to start advocating for flat closure and make institutional change happen in our medical system. Thank you so much for being here today and speaking about these important topics with me. So, Kim, let's start. Why do you think clear language is important?
Hi, Kirsten. Thanks for having me on. Clear language is important for a shared understanding and setting expectations between the patient and the surgeon. Historically, going flat was the default. So it was just what you did if you didn't want breast reconstruction. I think over the years, it slowly became sort of put off onto the plastic surgeon to pay attention to the aesthetics. And I think there's been a degradation in the quality of mastectomy closures without reconstruction over the years. So women who tell their surgeon that they want to be flat, it is very hard, especially in the absence of, if you don't have pictures, it's very, very hard to make to know as the patient, to know that you've been clear with your surgeon and that they understand what you expect you will look like when you wake up. So that's why it's so important to have a specific, clearly defined term for a smooth, flat chest wall post-mastectomy. And we didn't have that until spring of this year in the United States. And I don't think, from what I've seen, I don't think there's anything around the world that's similar. You don't have anything in Germany,
correct?
No, we
don't have anything in German like that. And I think I only saw it from the US and neither, like, from no other country until now.
Yeah, I think it's a paradigm shift that we're experiencing. So women going flat are starting to demand equal treatment for our equal consideration for our aesthetics. And that's what sort of led to this, this new term, aesthetic flat closure. So our National Cancer Institute, which is a division of our federal government, defined aesthetic flat closure in their Dictionary of Cancer Terms. So it's an official definition that's sanctioned by, you know, at the government. And it's a first step towards clear communication to just have a term that's clearly defined. And now our job is to disseminate the term to make sure patients know about it, can use it, understand what it means, and also that to make sure providers know what it means and understand it. And we're, you know, just at the beginning of that learning curve now. So if a patient goes and asks their surgeon for an aesthetic flat closure, the surgeon may or may not have even heard the term. But at least now the patient can refer them to the NCI definition.
But if someone has never heard of this term, how can the surgeon then make sure that they actually provide what is meant by aesthetic flat closure?
That's a really good question. That's why we need professional surgical societies in the United States and elsewhere to take ownership of this and to incorporate it into their training protocols and their clinical practice protocols. And that's a pretty big job to get that integrated, because most patients aren't going to know. You know, as a patient, you're diagnosed, you're not an expert. It's the surgeon who's the expert, who should have this information and be providing it. We're just very early, you know, early on. So we're working with surgeons to try to spread the word.
So that they, when they talk to patients who are diagnosed, that they offer this as one term so they can talk actually about this option.
Yeah, and talk about the aesthetics of it and offer it as an affirmative choice, you know, alongside the other options. So we have an agency here. I'm trying to think of how to exactly explain it. There's a certifying body called the National Accreditation Program for Breast mm-hmm. Centers. It's a program of a College of Surgeons here in the United States. They delineate a clear protocol for plastic surgeons specifically when they're having the reconstructive consult. And right now, plastic surgeons are only required to talk about three things. They're required to talk about implant reconstruction. They're required to talk about muscle sparing flap and, you know, a muscle involving mm-hmm. flap. And that's it. But it would be very easy for them to include as a fourth item, aesthetic flap closure. And that way it would be presented as a legitimate reconstructive choice that women can affirmatively make rather than just, oh, it's, we just won't talk about it because it's just the default and you don't care how you look.
And do you, like, in the work you have done with this, also with this term, do you think that this helps also pave the way for them to think about different ways of doing this? Because what I've seen in our groups and on all these pictures, there are many different ways to provide someone with an aesthetic flat closure. And like, if you don't talk about options, or if you had never heard of this option, you can also not talk about what they will actually do, right?
Yeah, exactly. So there's a lot of different specific surgical techniques that can be used either alone or in combination to give you a good, nice, smooth contour. So at the very basic minimum is just removing all the excess tissue that otherwise would have been left after scooping out the mm-hmm. breast tissue, the glandular tissue. So that's like extending the incision a little bit, perhaps under the arm. It's going to depend on the patient's body. You know, like some patients aren't going to really need any extra tissue removed after the mastectomy. It'll be very simple. But the larger bodied you are, the larger breasted you are, the more of this so-called redundant tissue that they have to manage. They call it surgical management. So they either remove it or they rearrange it. A lot of times after a mastectomy, there's concavity because they've gone down to the muscle. And there are techniques that surgeons can use to sort of minimize the concavity by rearranging some of the mm-hmm. tissues that are still there, repurposing some of the skin or repurposing some of the fat or rotating it around. There's all sorts of different surgical techniques that they can use. And scar placement is another thing. It's another thing that's important to consider because a lot of women have very strong preferences of how they want their scars. Some women want the scars on the inframammary fold, which is like at the bottom. I think the most common incision pattern, according to our research, was just like straight across through mm-hmm. the middle. But there's Y incisions. There's so many different options. But, you know, patients don't know to ask for these things. And I think right now that's why it's really important to push for patients to be able to access a plastic surgeon. Plastic surgeons are the people who are already trained in all of these techniques, are familiar with the language, are familiar with the options, and can really speak to the patient's aesthetic concerns. Right now, most surgical oncologists don't have that capacity right now.
Okay.
So that's one reason why in the US we're pushing for access to plastics for women going flat.
Well, that's really different from Germany. Because here you can get a really good result from just an oncological surgeon.
I think in Germany, oncoplastic training may be more common than in the United States. In the United States, most of our mastectomies are done by general mm-hmm. surgeons most of them don't have additional oncoplastic training. So if they do know about these oncoplastic techniques that we talked about, mm-hmm. tissue rearrangement stuff, if they do know about it, they probably don't do it. They probably aren't very comfortable doing
because
it.
Because they were not trained in it, like in the other specialty, like in plastic surgery.
Yeah. Not trained in it. And so therefore just not comfortable with it. You know, they don't want to do something that they don't feel they can do properly. And You know, that's understandable. And so that's why, I mean, I guess in Germany, if most of your surgeons, I would love to see data on this, but if most of your breast surgeons already have oncoplastic training, you're actually ahead of us, because that's one of our goals. You know, you wouldn't need a plastic surgeon to do it if your oncology surgeon could, yeah. Right? It would be much simpler, easier to coordinate care. You know, there's ideally every surgeon doing a mastectomy would have oncoplastic training.
I don't really know if that's part of the curriculum in German university training for surgeons. This is something I will ask my doctor. Then I can tell you that later. Do you think, Kim, that if we have this clear language and patients and their doctors can communicate with these terms, that it will also make the surgeons more accountable for what they do?
Absolutely. That was a big part of why I felt such a urgent need to get this term on the books. Because what happened to me, my personal story, where I asked to be flat, I was very clear, it was smooth, flat result, were the words that were in my consult notes. I had a plastic surgeon whose only job was to do a flat closure. I mean, I did everything right, and even then, there was enough ambiguity that when I went to the hospital after he intentionally left me with pockets for implants, you know, mm-hmm. excess skin. When I went to the hospital, there was no mechanism for accountability, because on the agreement that you sign before surgery, the surgical consent form, it simply said mastectomy, bilateral wound closure or something. Like, it wasn't specific enough that it was provable, you know, that was what we had agreed to. It wasn't good enough to have just words mm-hmm. in the consult notes. It hinged on the surgical consult. So if patients can get aesthetic flat closure on their surgical consent form,
then
there's no ambiguity. There's no gray area. Everyone knows the term is clearly defined by a third mm-hmm. party. So you can go and look and see patients want a smooth contoured chest wall.
Well, it's really great that you coined this term and that it's possible now to put this on the form and to make them accountable.
Yeah, it's really important. And I just want to say, I actually suggested to the National Cancer Institute that they define flat closure. They came back with aesthetic flat closure. They are, you know, they're the experts. It's their job to, you know, have clear language and a good definition. And I sort of suggested the framework, and then they came back with aesthetic flat closure. So I give a lot of kudos and credit to those guys, MD, PhDs up there at the National Cancer Institute for doing that. I was just so happy to see that. I've been working towards that for, you know, 3 years.
It turned out great. Thank you, Kim, so much for sharing your story. We have to move on to Devorah now. And she will elaborate a different aspect of aesthetic flat closure.
Yeah, well, thank you. First of all, as Kim said, I'm really excited to be here. This is a first in many respects. I'm so sorry, though, that it's just going to be our voices. I put on like my best shirt for this podcast, not realizing or not thinking like, no one's going to see you, Devorah. All right. Well, at least I feel good. And that's always key. We all have to feel good. So I'm going to segue from what Kim was talking about. It's a perfect segue, actually. She was talking about clear language and aesthetic flat closure. I'm going to talk about informed consent and what that is. And given that this is one of my most favorite topics because I'm a lawyer, I'm going to just plunge into this with great passion. All right, so the premise for informed consent is that each person, and I'll just say each woman, because we're talking about informed consent in the context of aesthetic flat closure, that every woman is presumed competent to give informed consent, and that she has agency over all of her medical decision making. That means that unless a woman is not competent and has been proven that she's not mm-hmm. competent, she has the right to give in, consent to any medical treatment or procedure that's going to affect her body. So that's the premise, is a patient's autonomy. What is informed consent, and what is the difference between informed consent and just plain vanilla consent? Well, consent is just by itself, it's a very broad term. And informed consent further defines it. It basically says that without information, you can't properly give consent. And what does that mean? It means that when you go to your consult, the doctor, and I am speaking in broad terms, I'm not referring to a specific legal system because, you know, although I do have background in the German legal system, I'm not talking about the German legal system. I'm not even talking about the quote unquote American legal system because we have 50 states, and it's particular to each state. But in general, one can say that when you go to your consult, the doctor is obligated to give you all pertinent facts regarding the proposed treatments or procedures so that you can make an informed decision and thereby give informed consent.
Okay, let me ask one question. So if, like we hear in a lot of women that talk to us and that are also in our Facebook groups, if a surgeon just talks about reconstruction and you only hear about reconstruction and not about the option of going flat, are they even able to do like this informed consent if there's a whole option that they leave out?
The answer is no, because that's part of informed consent. The doctor needs to provide you with all possible options, and all of the risks and benefits associated with each option. It's like giving you a complete menu. You can't just say that we have egg sandwiches. You have to say, what are the other options on the menu that you can choose from? Because at the end of the day, the actual decision is going to happen because the woman has had a complete menu of options, including the risks and benefits associated with each option. And that's how you get to informed consent. It's not the actual decision. It's how you get to that decision. And that's actually a very that's part of how one analyzes legal decision-making in the United States. It's not the decision per se, because people might arrive at different decisions. I might want an aesthetic flat closure. You might want reconstructed breast bounds. So that particular outcome is not relevant. What's relevant is the journey. How do we get to that particular outcome? And so to do this, because the procedure in this case is invasive, we are removing a woman's breast. The doctor is, in my opinion, legally obligated to tell the woman what she can do afterwards. So Kim was talking about, I think it was three, potentially, well, four options, I think she mentioned. The doctor has to tell the patient what those options are and has to explain the risks and benefits associated with each of those options. And so the next piece of informed decision making, which I think a lot of people leave out when they talk about informed consent, is that it has to be voluntary. And so without informed consent being voluntary, you cannot have informed consent. So here's an example. If the doctor has a sort of a preference for reconstruction of breast mounds, that preference needs to be, let's say, put aside. He has to disclose the options in an impartial and objective manner. So saying, oh, you've got three options. Let's just say, we'll talk about two options. You've got two options. You can reconstruct your breast mounds or you can opt for an aesthetic flat closure. But you don't want the second one because you know what? You're not going to feel like a woman afterwards. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to look, you'll feel less than, or he might say, I would recommend the first option because then you'll feel more whole. You'll feel like you used to be. You'll be more of a woman. You'll be sexy. You'll be this and that. That's not impartial. Mm-hmm. That's not objective. And therefore, the woman who gives, quote unquote, informed consent later on, I don't believe she's really giving that voluntarily. It's not that the doctor's coercing her, but there is undue pressure and there is undue subjectivity, and women are vulnerable and they go into these consults with a million pressures. First, the first one being, it happened to me. I have breast cancer. How could this be? And they can't hear things. That's the other thing that's very important. When a woman goes into a consult, she literally cannot hear anything. Doesn't mean she's not intelligent or amazing or, you know, whatever, educated. It just means that she's a human being. She's received a diagnosis that's devastating, and she has to deal with it. And she has to deal with it very quickly. This is not something you sit on for months. It goes very quickly. And if you're in the consult and you can't hear, and the doctor's saying, well, we could, I'll refer you to the plastic surgeons for reconstruction. And when they say that, they mean reconstruction of the breast mounds, obviously. The woman's like, okay, okay. And everyone looks up to a doctor. Mm-hmm. You know, they should, but it shouldn't be, you know, without some form of, you know, contemplation or thinking or reflection about what he, and I'm saying he, because I don't like to say he, she, they. I'm very old fashioned. I just say he. We all know that these doctors are also females or they might have other identities, but I'm just saying he. I don't want to insult anybody. So if the doctor does not relay the information in an objective, neutral, disassociated, impassioned but disassociated way, then the risk is that the woman who's in the consult and is not able to really hear and absorb information, she's just going to say yes and to something where under normal circumstances, she might not have said yes. So I would argue that informed consent can only be informed consent if it's voluntary, and voluntary means that the doctor has presented all pertinent information on available options in a detached, objective, impartial manner. And there's another piece to informed consent that I wanted to talk about. Actually, I'm just going to give the rundown, because I think when you break something down, it's sort of easier to digest. It's like eating things and like instead of eating a whole loaf of bread, we eat like, you know, little bites.
It's a buffet,
right?
Yeah.
So I first talked about competency. So we're assuming competency, that's not an issue. The second piece I talked about was full and fair disclosure of all the options available to a woman, including all risks and benefits. The third piece is comprehension of the relevant information. I think that's also often sort of blown over. And I'm not saying that the woman can't comprehend, but like I said before, she's very vulnerable in that moment. And it could be that she needs some time to also think about it. That's number one. Number two, a woman should never go into a consult by herself. That's like the golden rule. And I don't care if she brings in 25 people, whatever she needs to make herself feel comfortable and available. And she should not be taking notes because she should be trying to listen with her head, and her friends, her supporters, her advocates, whoever's with her should be the ones taking notes. She should also come arrive at the consult with questions. So beforehand, she should prepare a list of questions. She should ask her friends to also draft questions. The more questions, the better. The more ears, the better. So this is all part of comprehension, because if the woman is there by herself and she can't hear and she can't take notes simultaneously, and the doctor's saying, well, I'll refer you to plastic so you can get your breast mounds reconstructed because I know you want to feel like a whole woman afterwards, that is a recipe that's bound for a disaster. Yeah. And so that's the other thing. Comprehension of the relevant information. It has various components. It can be very complicated because everyone has different circumstances. I was lucky because, as I mentioned, I'm a lawyer. So I went in there and I had six lawyer friends with me in my consult. And, you know, we lawyered up for my consult, which was good because I didn't have to do anything. I could just sit there, try to listen, and all my friends were taking notes. So afterwards, I could go over the notes because I literally didn't hear half the things they actually wrote down. And I'm an educated, intelligent person, but I'm a human being. And at the end of the day, we're only human beings. And when we're put in vulnerable situations,
it's really overwhelming.
It's overwhelming. And I know I'm talking a lot about this topic, but it is sort of complicated. I just wanted to say one last thing about what informed consent is. I did mention that it needs to be voluntary. So the last thing is something I would add is in the United States, we talk about the reasonable person, meaning we make reference to this imaginary quote unquote reasonable person. What kind of information would the quote unquote reasonable person need to hear in order to give informed consent? And I argue that the standard here is not the reasonable person, it's the woman herself. It's a subjective standard. The doctor needs to understand who he is talking to because we all have different bodies, we have different diagnoses, we have different needs. And it's really important. That's another reason why we need a buddy, someone who knows us well, who can say, hey, wait a second, you know, my friend, I don't know, has A, B, and C, or my friend, you know, this is a particular set.
Or she does rock climbing, you know, she needs to use her arms and she needs to be flexible. Is this going to be possible afterwards?
That's right. That's right. My friend is a yoga instructor or whatever. I might forget to say, oh, by the way, I'm a yoga instructor. I need to have, because I need to be able to stretch
in my upper body and to be flexible there.
Exactly. Or whatever the circumstance is, it's really important that the patient, the woman, has the opportunity to also inform the doctor who she is. Because the doctor might not even know the patient. You know, doctors have so many patients. So it's not like they, you know, it's like, oh, you know, hi, Devorah, how's it going? Like, they don't know me. So we have to introduce ourselves to the doctor. So it's a two-way street. But that's part of informed consent and informed decision-making. It doesn't take away the doctor's obligation to explain all the options, but it gives the doctor more information. So there can be, as we say in the United States, shared decision-making. So there's an understanding of what the woman's particular needs are. They are front and center. And lastly, I want to just sort of make full circle here with what Kim was talking about, clear language and why that's important. Clear language is important because in order to be able to make an informed decision and thereby give informed consent, there has to be a meeting of the minds. And in Kim's case, there was no meeting of the minds. In her head, there was, but in the doctor's, there wasn't. Not only that, I don't think he particularly cared about meeting of the minds. So the reason why the last piece of informed consent is so important is to achieve meeting of the minds. And what's that piece? It all needs to be in writing. Informed consent is only valuable, in my opinion, if it's explicitly put in writing. So if you get a pre-printed form that says mastectomy, no, do not sign it, because that means nothing. Of course it's a mastectomy. That's not the issue. The issue is, what's going to happen to my chest after the mastectomy? Yeah. It's too vague. It says nothing. And although Kim did nothing wrong, and in fact, Kim did everything right, you couldn't possibly do more. She just had her situation was that the doctor didn't care. It's very important that each woman, after she makes her informed decision, that she sees it in writing, and that the doctor sees it, and that there are two signatures on that that indicate there can be no misunderstanding. Mm-hmm. There's a meeting of the minds. What's going to happen? I'm going to get an aesthetic flap closure. You're going to do what, you know, the National Cancer Institute describes as a flat chest wall contour, or I'm going to reconstruct my breast mound, or breast mounds, not my breast mounds, but breast mounds. And we all are on the same page. That's how we give informed consent. That is like it's a big recipe, or a very all-encompassing recipe. But it's important to understand that it's not just like going in and telling your hairdresser that you want to have a haircut.
That can go awfully wrong too, because you're not on the same page.
I know. That's another podcast. Yeah.
Wow.
So that was my...
Yeah, great. Yeah. Thanks for that, Deborah.
You're welcome.
Okay, Juliet, it's your turn now. You are from the UK,
excellent.
And you wanted to talk about stigmatization, right? And visibility.
Yep. Yeah. Again, thanks for having me, Kristen. It's really good to be here. Just want to say, listening to Kim and Devorah takes me right back to my consultation, because I had none of that, meeting of minds, no informed consent, none of that stuff. It was literally, you need a mastectomy, you'll have reconstruction, won't you? Here are some photos, here are some videos, have a look at this woman, she's had mastectomy, and now look at her, she's had reconstruction, I'll book you in with a plastic surgeon. That was what happened to me. And like Devorah said, I didn't hear any of that. I was shocked and completely, I wasn't there. It was like I was floating on the ceiling somewhere. Luckily, my husband was with me, and he was kind of listening and watching. And when I left that consult, it was with my breast surgeon, I was kind of thinking, fine, I'm having a Dieppe flap reconstruction, and the guy even said a tummy tuck. So, it was like, whoa, okay. I'm going to go and buy new jeans. Fantastic. I'm really happy about this, and it wasn't until I got home and started thinking about it that I thought, okay, well, hold on. 8-10 hours operation, maybe more than one operation. This really doesn't sound like what I want to go through. And I had no idea at all about mastectomy, about breast cancer, because I knew nobody that had it. And then I started Googling, basically typing in, every woman that has mastectomy have reconstruction? And the answer was no, they don't actually. And you're not mad. You're not completely gaga. You are as sane as the next woman who wants reconstruction, So that's where I came from. And it's just, I can't believe the terribleness of my consultation, because it really was. It was literally, you're having reconstruction. There is no such thing as flat closure. It's just that or nothing. So what am I talking about? Visibility, stigmatization. As far as I'm concerned, many breast surgeons in the UK still try to get women to have reconstruction. They don't like the idea of women staying flat, and they certainly don't like the idea of women asking to have their healthy breasts removed. But I'd never seen anybody who'd had a mastectomy and who had remained flat. And as I said, I Googled, what does it look like? Saw some photos and thought, okay, no, this is more like what I what I want to do. And it was then that I found a really brilliant support group in the UK called Flat Friends. And they work with healthcare professionals, mm-hmm. with hospitals, with breast care nurses to try and get them to understand that many women don't want to have reconstruction of their breast mm-hmm. mounts. So I work with them, or I used to work with them a lot. They kind of go from the strategy point of view, you know, working to change minds of healthcare professionals. And I started taking my top off after I'd had my second mastectomy and sort of showing my scars, because like I said, I'd never seen mm-hmm. anybody who was flat, whether that was a one breast or no breasts. And I just keep working and keep trying to get media opportunities to try and get my body, other people's bodies, other flat women out there to show that it is beautiful still, that we are still women, that we haven't lost any of our femininity, and that we can be confident, happy, normal women just living their lives. It's just that we don't have any breasts anymore. And I think for me, trying to get out there as well, that it's a positive choice that we've taken to be flat. It's not that we are taking that choice as a negative thing. It is a positive choice, and it's a choice that we can make only when we're given all of the mm-hmm. options at our consultation. So and I think by other people seeing me or the other women that work to get their bodies out there, that can only help to decrease the stigmatization of what it is to live as a flat woman. You know, there's still a taboo, I think, in the UK, definitely. I think the more of us that can show how we are, what we look like, whether that's with our top clothes on or with our clothes off, you know, it doesn't really matter. But we are flat women. We're living our lives and we're happy. You know, we're trying to make turn a negative, really negative, horrible situation into a positive one for ourselves. And I think it doesn't matter what other people mm-hmm. think. As long as I'm happy, as long as other flat women are happy with who they are, then that's the most important thing. And that hopefully will start to decrease the stigmatization of it.
Yeah. Since putting yourself out there and also the other women putting themselves out there visually in the UK, did you receive pushback from like medical professionals? Like they were was someone saying to you you'll kind of wake up in a few years and regret your decision, or that someone when you went back to the hospital, for example, said this, like, you're not a woman or you don't look like a woman, something like that?
I mean, I had it a little bit, not too much, I have to say. With my breast surgeon, who is a general mm-hmm. surgeon, not a plastic surgeon, I had to ask him constantly for him to remove my second breast, to have my contralateral prophylactic mastectomy, because I had really large mm-hmm. breasts. They were a double G cup, and I really personally didn't want to live with one breast. So every time I saw him, I had to keep asking him, and he would say, well, when you're having a reconstruction, and I would say, when are you going to remove my second breast? You know, this went on for about 18 months, I'd say. And he never actually said to me, you know, you'll regret it, you're not like a woman, but he was really reluctant and it took a lot of pressurizing from mm-hmm. me to keep demanding what I wanted. So since I suppose the most recent thing that I've done, which is an advert for Dove, which has been in the US, been over here now as well. I've seen some really negative comments online in various forums and things like that. In the flat forum, they're amazing. Everybody is really happy and likes to see the representation, you know, and I know that it's helped them to get across to their families and their friends how they are, how they feel about their bodies. But I think people who have never come across a woman with no breasts or a woman with one breast, they find that a lot more difficult to accept. And I'm not going to tell you what mm-hmm. I've read, but I have read some really awful things about me in those adverts. I'm so sorry, really.
It takes so much to put yourself out there, and then it's such a personal thing, and you're also very vulnerable.
It is.
And then someone just slashing that.
To be honest, I feel happy and confident enough in myself and strong enough that I just disregard that, because it's not important to me. I don't know who they are. I don't know them. They're just words. And actually, some of the stuff just made me laugh. But on the other hand, I have had so many positive comments from women who have really been trying to decide what they wanted to do after their mastectomies. I've had really happy and kind comments from the families of women who are flat, you know, saying, I'm so happy that, you know, you're out there, because it helps me to understand what my partner or daughter or whatever has gone through. So I'd say in general, the increasing visibility and representation has been a massive positive for me, but also I think for all those other women that are trying to work out what to do or are flat and have never actually been able to let people know that's the way they're living. Yeah.
Yes. Wow.
Yeah, it's been an interesting few years, that's for sure.
So how long, that's something I didn't ask the other two, how long is this been going on in the UK? Because in Germany, it's a very recent thing that we got together to talk about things like aesthetic flat closure. Like, we still don't have a term in German for that. We're still working on that because we only met last year. How long has this been going on in the UK?
Well, I think the flat movement in the UK has probably been going on for about, I'd say, 6-7 years. So Flat Friends has probably been going on that long, I'd say. I think the founder of Flat Friends came across the US group, or a US group first, and then decided to start her own UK group. I don't think we in the UK have a term like aesthetic flat closure either. In the UK, I see so many, finishes that are awful, you know, like the ones that Kim's talking about and how she was left. So I think it's definitely something that in the UK we need to be working on as well, and try to get this term accepted as well. But I think the flat movement, maybe 6-7 years, but in the last, you know, three or four years, it's definitely gathered a lot more pace, and people are talking about it loads more. Whether that, you know, in the press, we've got about 1,500, I think, in Flat Friends now.
That's a closed Facebook group, right?
It's closed Facebook group, yes. And there are about 1,500 women in that now. So it's pretty big, you know. And I'm sure there are many, many thousands more women who are living flat, but don't want to join a support group, don't feel the need. So,
yeah, or they don't know that it exists.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I didn't know it existed, so you have to search for it, don't you? I think that's about me.
Thank you so much. It's really interesting, I think, because what Julia just said, that you stumbled upon a US group and then decided, or someone stumbled upon the US group and then decided to like do that in the UK. For me, it was very similar. I'm like, my operation in 2019, it was prophylactic in nature. I carried the BRCA gene, and I actually had months on my hands to research what I wanted to do, because to me they said, like when I was at the genetic counselor, they said, well, you have this option of, and here we are again, Deborah, at your thing, they said, you have the option of going to increased surveillance, and you have to go to the doctor every 6 months and every year get an MRI, or you can take, you can have a prophylactic mastectomy and get really nice boobs and reduce your risk by, I don't know, more than 90%. And I had very small breasts, and every doctor I came across was telling me that I could get a boob job, and that they would make me beautiful boobs. And like, no one talked about what it means to live with this knowledge of cancer. And I've had so many people in my family die of breast cancer or ovarian cancer. And for me, it was more this emotional thing that was really hard to incorporate into my life. And then I started to feel really sick, because when you go to the doctor as a healthy person, I had the feeling that my life was revolving around this. I constantly had to make appointments with doctors, go to the hospital, go to my gynecologist. And everybody kept saying, well, you can get this operation. And I felt really pressured to remove this breast tissue, and also pressured by those taking care of me to do reconstruction. And I'm a very active person, mm-hmm. and I like rock climbing. I do triathlon. I go sailing, riding, whatever. Everything that's outdoors and that's sports, I love that. And I love to move. And I have two nephews. Now I have three. I had two nephews at the time. And I wanted to just, you know, have this operation, reduce my risk, and then get back on with my life, which is a very active life. And I remember my consult, I had a female doctor, and she did not hear me. And I had a friend with me. I didn't take six. Like, I felt already bad that I had one backup person with me, which I only did because I stumbled upon this site in the US not putting on a shirt. And before going to my consult, I printed out this sheet and I translated it into German because there was nothing in German at the time. And I took a friend. I had all my questions and I realized that she was not hearing me. And I had heard about Kim's story and I was like, okay, I'm not going to let this doctor operate on me. Thank you, Kim, so much for this. and then a friend who actually chose reconstruction, she said, well, I talked to this other doctor at the same hospital and I asked him, what would you prefer your wife or daughter choose as an option? And he was very clear. He said, I would advise to only do a mastectomy and do not do reconstruction because you are very young and you will have a lot of operations down the road. And like, I only had the option of choosing silicone. And he said, if you're going to be 80, you have to go have another operation every 10, 15 years. And you have all the risks with every operation. And the more often we operate on you, like, it's going to become even riskier. And I didn't feel comfortable with that. And I had read Catherine Guthrie's book, Flat, Reclaiming My Body from Breast mm-hmm. Cancer. And a lot of the thought processes that she describes in the book, I felt like she was taking them from my head. I had the same questions and I just wanted to be able to move. And then I booked my operation with a doctor I had never seen before, but whom I knew was pro aesthetic flat closure. And he did a really good job. And I saw him on the morning of my operation. And I was only able to do this because of all the work you had done in the US. And then I was like, okay, this can't be happening that we have nothing like that in Germany. There's one very great person, Uta Melle. She did, I think, two very interesting photo ops about the Amazon project with women who are flat. But there was no group trying to change the system. And we got together last year in June and talked about the German NGO system, which is a bit complicated if you want to found something. And none of us are a lawyer, so we had to kind of figure that out. And then we met and we decided we wanted to do this. And we founded ourselves in September. And a lot of our work is based on what we see in the US and in the UK. And I talked to Fia from Sweden and I listened to her talking on the podcast Flat. And this is so, like, this whole international flat community has given us so much to work from because, like, you have this flyer. Like, this was a lot of pre-work for us. We couldn't just take it and translate it. It didn't work with this German system. And but we knew the flyer was there and we based our flyer on your flyer. And also the podcasts that are available in English. This is why we are starting our podcast now, because a lot of people are more comfortable listening on their way to work or when mm-hmm. they, I don't know, do stuff around the house instead of reading all the time. I think it's very good to have something to listen to and to listen to different people and different women and about their journeys and why they choose what they choose, either reconstruction, of the breast mound or reconstruction of the chest wall. Mm. And the more you know and the more you can listen to something and read and look at photos, the better your understanding gets of what is going to happen to my body, what is going to happen to me, how will I feel afterwards, how will my body feel, will there be numbness, will I be able to move, will I be able to pick up my children, how long does it take? And that's something I feel that even if a doctor wants to talk about these things, they are in some aspects not even competent enough to do it because they did not have the procedure done themselves. And in Germany, there's a culture of, it's called Selbsthilfe. Deborah, can you help me? Is there an equivalent in English?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say self-help, but it's really self-advocacy. That's how I would translate it. Self-advocacy, because self-advocacy implies that you are proactive in getting information so that you can figure out a solution to your problem, and you're not relying on other people to do the solving for you. You know what I mean? So you are the active. You are the active person. You're not the object. You're the subject. So that's what I would say.
But it's just the name they give these organizations. Like there's one that helps BRCA people get like all the knowledge where to go and also talk to other people who are in the same situation. It's just the term we have. Maybe we should change this term as well because, as you say, it's very passive, and not so much on the person.
Well, I mean, the term itself, I think, is it's the counterpart to self-advocacy. I mean, the Selbst part of it implies that you yourself are doing the activity. And so I don't think it's a bad term at all. But I think what it means is self-advocacy, and that's what I'm hearing across the board. And what you said just a few minutes ago about the doctors are fine for the medical stuff, but really they're not, and I've said this before, they're not the ones who have lived through this.
Exactly.
So they are not competent, as you said, to really inform where it counts. Because at the end of the day, yes, they'll explain all the medical options, and that's vital. But a woman wants to know, how am I going to feel? What will I be able to do? Will I have, you know, how will this impede me in, you know, these activities? You know, did you feel sexy? I mean, that's what everyone wants to know at the end of the day. Because that's just how we are as a society. Yeah. We want to be attractive to other people. We want to feel attractive. And unfortunately, there's this huge elephant in the room called women need to have breasts to be women. Yeah. And that is the most ridiculous thing ever. The problem is that women buy into this. But it's a whole other topic because it has to do with a woman's self-worth, how she looks at herself, you know, how she feels about herself, and so much about how we as women feel about ourselves is actually dictated by people who aren't women. And then other women start to like carry the banner and they're preaching the same thing. And, you know, you really have to, think about like, what is going on here? I made one note that while everyone was talking, and I think it was when Julia was talking, and she was mentioning her experiences with different reactions to her advocacy. And I was thinking about flat ballerinas.
Yes.
And nobody has ever, like, I've never heard anyone be critical of a flat ballerina. Never say anything about, oh, she has no boobs, she's not a woman. In fact, quite the opposite. What a beautiful, slim body and what movement. And they don't see her as being a man.
That's really great. That's really great, the association that you had.
Yeah.
Julia?
I was in a shop the other day as well. It was like, it's a shop like Lululemon called Sweaty Betty that we have in the UK. So it's quite an upmarket athletic wear kind of clothes. I love them. They're really comfortable to wear. And I was in there the other day and I said to them, I met an ambassador in there. And I said, oh, I think you need to have me as a flat ambassador, you know, for your clothes. And I looked at them both, actually, and they looked at me and both of them had, they were flat. They had breasts, but they were both flat. And it was like, so you're the same as me, actually. Nobody's saying that you're not a woman or you're not feminine. You know, I don't have breasts, but my chest looks exactly the same in clothes as yours do, you know? And I think that's the kind of thing that we need to get more out there, you know, that we're no different to other women. It's just that we don't have those physical breasts anymore, you know?
And we don't have the nipples.
Yeah, we don't have the nipples.
You know, what can we do? We don't have the nipples. You can't have everything.
No. The other thing I was just going to mention was when we were talking about women who have the experience of how it feels like, what it feels like after a mastectomy. So earlier this afternoon, I was talking to a woman because I do some volunteering for peer-to-peer counselling, or not the counselling, just chat really. And this woman wanted to talk to somebody who had been through a mastectomy because she was absolutely so scared that she didn't know what it was going to be like, you know. So I talked to her for about an hour. She had all these questions, just what you said, Devorah, you know, how will I feel? Will it be numb? What can I do? When can I drive again? And all this kind of thing. And I think that's just so, so important that those of us who've been through it can try, you know, find a way to tell other women that actually it's the fear of the unknown, but you probably will be okay. Yep.
So. I agree.
I totally agree too. Yeah. I found the concept very unsettling that when you reconstruct the breast mount, that you see something that you cannot feel. And that's actually something that's like one of the most positive things that I realized after my operation. I don't see anything that I cannot feel. Like, I can feel almost everything on my chest. I'm like, I always say this is my jackpot, kind of. I don't see anything that I cannot feel, and everything that I see, I can feel. And that's, for me, it's integrity, kind of. I feel very not pleased with my body, but I'm really at home in my body like this. It's very, very good to be like this. Yeah.
You know, Kirsten, I know quite a few women who initially chose implant reconstruction and later explanted, so they removed the implants and went flat. So many of the women that I know who've been through that say the same thing, exactly what you just said. They never felt like the breast mounds were theirs, were part of them. It was foreign, and they were disturbed by seeing it. And that's not the experience of all women that get implants. Mm-hmm. Many women are happy with their implants. But for these women, they were happier and felt more like themselves after explant.
Yeah.
I just wanted to mention them since none of us are explanted here, I don't think.
Yeah. Does anyone want to add anything else? I think this was a great discussion to actually close this first episode and give a shout out to all the other flatties on October 7th to really celebrate the day and be flat and fabulous and happy and just comfortable.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, this International Flat Day on October 7th, this was the brainchild of a couple of women who explanted, actually, including Christy, our vice president. When I heard the idea for International Flat Day, I just thought it was such a fabulous idea because really that was where I really started thinking about the international women outside of the United States. And I, you know, as I hear you ladies speak, I just feel like this is the future of flat advocacy is international collaboration so that we can all take each other's work and translate it and use it to help women in our nations. And I think we're stronger together. We have a unified message, and I'm just so happy to know you guys and to, you know, I'm looking forward to working with you guys and just putting flat on the menu, so to speak, to make sure that, you know, the next generation of women have a better experience than we did.
I had a better experience because of all your work. Like, I'm really grateful. It's happening. Mm-hmm.
Proof of concept right there. Proof of concept. And the next generation of women, our daughters, you know, hopefully we're going to get to a point where they can go into their consult and they will hear about aesthetic plaque closure directly from the surgeon. There will be no question about whether that's an acceptable choice. There's be no question about whether they will get, you know, attention paid to their aesthetics. And that's the end of it. And when we reach that point, that is the goal. That is the end game. Yeah. And I think we're getting there. I think it's just, you know, we have to stay the course and continue to work with each other, and we'll get there.
And in the UK this month, it's Breast Cancer Awareness Month, all of October. So we are all tweeting, Instagramming, Facebooking away. I'm obviously concentrating on flat awareness, flat aesthetic closure.
Juliet, you have to, like, can you hear Juliet?
I can't hear her all of a sudden.
I can't hear her.
You cut out for a minute there, Juliet. We can't hear your audio.
Okay.
Well, she was talking about, you know, celebrating Breast Cancer Awareness Month and incorporating flat awareness into that. Flat Friends UK is doing Flat Fortnite right now, which is on Facebook. I'm not sure if they're on Instagram or not, but definitely on Facebook. They're sharing stories and images of women who are happy flat, and just seeing that, you know, women need to see that, but surgeons need to see it too. You know, medical providers need to see that women are happy flat, and our reasons for going flat are as diverse as, you know, any other part of humanity. We, you know, and it's a legitimate choice, and there's no one right choice. It's not, you know, it's okay to choose to go flat, and it's important to share our stories, because there's nothing is that impactful like a narrative, a personal narrative. So really appreciate the work Flat Friends are doing there.
Great. Thanks for stepping in, Kim. Okay, so we are a bit over the time already, but I am so grateful that you all made the time and that we had this great conversation. And yes, let's do it again. And
absolutely.
Have a good day in the US and have a good evening in the UK. And yes, just take care and stay healthy.
Thank you, Kirsten.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us and for offering this platform. It was really delightful.
Thanks.
Until we speak again.
Hi.
Yeah. Cheers.